if you want to get rich quick, then you want volatility because you want, you know, those 10Xs, but you also should be prepared for those, you know, going to zeros. If you're wanting to build generational wealth, then now is the right time.
This is the Baby Bathwater Podcast, an exceptionally unscripted and underproduced adventure within entrepreneurial reality. Hosted by Hollis Carter and Michael Lovich, co-founders of the Baby Bathwater Institute and the most reluctant podcasters this side of the Mississippi.
All right, everybody. Excited to be here today. Have an exciting conversation that has had a lot of buzz lately, and a lot of people have some idea what they're doing. A lot of people have no idea what they're doing, and some people seem to know everything, but we know it's just a giant maze out there, and it's hard to figure out where to get information. So we're doing our best to try to find some people and have a real conversation about it. So there's some posts in the group about this topic, and Max Herdedan was nice enough to introduce us here to Trent, who's on the call. And we also have Niraj, Baby Bathwater member, who has taken an extreme deep dive in the recent COVID time into this space and is consuming his mind. So basically, we're just going to have a conversation about the subject of DeFi and crypto and what's going on. It's obviously a giant can of worms, and we'll try to keep it on track, but I imagine this will go a little bit all over the place. But we have a slight agenda, and we've got some questions from everyone. So Trent, I would love if you could just, in the briefest fashion, because I know what you do is quite large, but kind of the boilerplate Reader's Digest version of how you got into the space and what you're doing with it here today.
Cool, man. Thank you for having me. And what I do is principal at ZeroCap, which is an Australian wealth management firm, prime broker for digital assets. You could basically consider us like a private bank. We offer a global service for OTC trading or over-the-counter trading with deep liquidity, institutional grade custody, which is covered by dollar-for-dollar insurance, and essentially a range of yield-generating products. So just like in your internet banking, you would have different interest-bearing accounts or yield accounts. We have a number of those that we offer as well. So essentially like a private bank for digital assets. And you asked how I got into it, essentially I had a Venezuelan friend, through 2015 and 2016 talk to me about, crypto and about Bitcoin. Now, if you know anything about Venezuela, they're pretty creative in terms of how they conduct commerce, from holding value in, whiskey and rum, to cigarettes, just because of the Bolivar is just so hyperinflated, you just lose value day in and day out. So he got me interested in it. I had come across Bitcoin earlier, but didn't really make the connect philosophically that really connected with me. Once I sort of, learned more about how this, how Bitcoin allowed you to be able to bypass sort of nation states and government restrictions, interventions, hyperinflation, monetary policies that aren't necessarily beneficial for the people, then that's when I started to get involved. So had an exit in 2016, and that's when I really deep dived into the space and started the Blockchain Association of Australia, which we ran for a couple of years. We actively promoted, uplifted the local blockchain ecosystem. We brought in thought leaders from around the world. We trained developers up on Solidity. We hosted events, hackathons, executive roundtables with industry leaders. 2017 had a VC fund. We invested in projects at an equity and token level and was fortunate enough to get into some really successful projects. And we also helped them proactively to go to market. In 2019, throughout the winter of crypto, we started building what we termed the financial business of tomorrow. And fortunately, that tomorrow is today. We saw that run up. We saw the bubble burst in 2018. We saw the irrational exuberance of Main Street retail investors jumping out as quickly as they jumped in. Investors taking out loans against their homes, buying at the top, selling at the bottom, which is the exact opposite of smart money. We saw that family offices and institutional investors were on the sidelines waiting for an entry, but they didn't necessarily have the institutional protections that they were used to. So that's why we started building ZeroCap, the private bank for digital assets, where we can clear $20 million in one block with minimal price slippage. If you try to buy that on an exchange, firstly, good luck on one exchange. Secondly, the price slippage that you would experience, plus, you know, the increase in the Bitcoin price. We built an institutional grade custody solution with dollar for dollar insurance. We built yield products so investors could find solace outside of traditional markets that were offering zero, you know, to 0.25%. And we also built a prime broker, which is a deep liquidity provider to exchanges, institutions in the space that need liquidity, custody, and credit services. And so, and importantly, on top, like underpinning all that, we built a global banking infrastructure for fiat or dollars on and off ramps that we provide to other crypto companies that don't have banking in the space. So there's a bit more around it, but I'm just conscious I've just spoken for a little bit, but that just sort of gives you the gamut of sort of how I got involved in the space.
That makes a lot of sense. And I know you could probably go on for an hour just on how this all happened and all the things you had to build around it. But I think that'll give people an idea that you're the real deal and you know what you're talking about in the space that you're playing.
Not sure about the deal, but certainly trying to. If you ask my girlfriend, there's some fresh mind about that.
Yeah. And then I just want to introduce Niraj a little bit because he will be, I think, slightly more articulate than myself on some of this, having dived a bit deeper into it. And, you know, hopefully we can get some good love out of this. But, you know, we have this private group that's been running, sharing lots of information. The last time there was a bull market like this, everyone got excited and started chatting a bunch and things happened. And as soon as it dove, it kind of got quiet. And obviously we're back in this kind of crazy bull time, and it's a lot of chatter now and everyone trying to figure out what to do. Niraj was had a nice offline conversation about how much he's diving in. We're probably going to have a little side channel that can provide deeper conversation and bring updates. And this is step one in starting to develop that conversation and the people who are really interested in this, getting more involved in the conversation and our way of supporting the people in the group in that. And so stoked to have you here and do this little co-host, and hopefully we can get some good nuggets out here.
Yeah, thanks for having me and good to meet you, Trent. Yeah, as Hollis said, I've gone quite deep into this in recent times and really gone down a rabbit hole and got very active in the space. So I guess I'm, you know, a few steps ahead in terms of where I was 3 or 4 months ago. But for me, this conversation is, I think Trent hit the nail on the head. He's mentioned it a couple of times, the idea of digital assets rather than crypto. And if we look at digital assets, that's really the whole space of everything that can be digitized, and cryptography and cryptocurrencies kind of underpin that. But that's probably a good place to start in terms of I guess diving into this with Trent, just to get a sense from you what you think the building blocks are in this space that somebody needs to understand to start navigating it. Like you know, what on earth is going on is another way of putting it.
How can you make something extremely complicated simple?
Well, that's with our customer set, primarily our role is education. The settlement, the trade execution, that's sort of secondary because, you know, ultimately what we need to do is educate traditional investors and how they move across into the space. But, you know, if we look at, you know, what sort of underpins it, you'd probably say, let's just look at Bitcoin first off. Now, it'd probably be good to get some definitions out, you know, out the way. So you look at Bitcoin, the network, so essentially a protocol for decentralized peer-to-peer or peer-to-peers that create, you know, essentially like a consensus without the need for a central authority to provide that trust. Then you've got Bitcoin, the currency, which is what we know today, which is what you know, essentially people are speculating on, which is essentially a reward for a proof of work mining process where miners solve extremely complex problems. There was a really interesting tweet a few years ago where a guy labeled, you know, he tried to explain it to someone as leaving your car idling 24/7 whilst it solves complex Sudoku problems. Now, that is, you know, one way to explain it, but it is quite challenging to be quite technical. But then you've also got blockchain, which underpins Bitcoin, which is essentially like a public ledger where the network records transactions, or the records are written or are recorded. And it's not just restricted to Bitcoin, there's multiple different blockchains. So in terms of the space and making it, you know, really simple, taking, you know, what is complex, make it simple, I think probably Bitcoin is the best way, you know, place to start with that, because that's what really revolutionized the space. That's what really revolutionized, you know, sort of value, how we perceive money, and even trust and value as well. So if you like, I can just drop into that, or if do you have any sort of questions or anything you wanted me to touch on?
I think that's probably a good start to lay a bit of an educational infrastructure, since that's probably the thing that most are familiar with, and some people are more advanced in this can, you know, press fast forward button, but I think it's important to kind of get into a simple infrastructure and everyone knows what that is.
So from an infrastructure perspective, I'd like to start at the, you know, what is money, value, and trust? Because if we really look at money, this is the question that consistently comes up with our customers, is Bitcoin doesn't have value. And it's like, okay, what is value? You know, what is money? Now, if we look at the functions of money, it has to function as a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value. So pretty much anything that fulfills these three functions can be considered money. Problem is that we look at the current state of now, you know, primarily baby bathwater is in the US, so I'll use US examples if I know them. But the US dollar functions as a medium of exchange wonderfully well, a unit of account. You have $5, $10, $20, $50 notes. But as a store of value, it's really failed over time, because a store of value is supposed to hold value over time. And so that's why when we look at, you know, what is money, that's where Bitcoin really comes into the frame. So as a medium of exchange, Bitcoin probably isn't great, the greatest. As a unit of account, certainly you've got 100 million Satoshis, or you can, it's divisible down to 8 decimal points. As a store of value, that's where it's really, you know, held. It's a lure for investors, much like gold has, which, you know, I'm sure we'll probably get into through the rest of this, this conversation. But if we look at, you know, what makes sound money, and particularly in times of economic turmoil, investors typically go to, you know, sound hard money like gold. Now, if we look at sound money based on, you know, Greek Aristotle principles, what we really need to look at is it has to be intrinsically valuable and scarce. And that is something that, as we know with the US dollar, you know, trillions being printed, there is no scarcity to it. So it wouldn't be classically known as sound money. It's portable, it's divisible, it's somewhat durable, but the scarcity is where it really falls down. And that's where Bitcoin, once again, holds a lot of the allure, which is the reason why gold has held the allure as well. I mean, it's been the money par excellence the last 5,000 years, not just because of its geological composition, but because the marketplace has decided that through scarcity and through the work of mining and the cost of mining, that there is value attached to it. Bananas would make a horrible form of money because there's just no durability to it. They aren't scarce.
Just to recap for a layman's term understanding of maybe the scarcity in mining piece, because we know what it looks like when the Fed prints a bunch of money. If I'm getting down to the most basic level of this, you know, technology, mining and scarcity, there's only so much, and mining is how it's being created, correct?
Yes. So if we look at Bitcoin, there is, I mean, we can get into the technicalities because technically there is no Bitcoin. There are only Satoshis. Bitcoin's like a, but you know, let's not get into that. So essentially there's 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be in existence, of which about 18.5 million is already in circulation. Of that 18.5 million, there's an estimated 2 to 3 million that has been lost over time. Now the last Bitcoin will probably be mined in 2140. And so what happens is through a process of proof of work, which is where miners once again compete to solve complex mathematical problems. They generate Bitcoin, they get rewarded with Bitcoin that then flows into the market. Now this scarcity for Bitcoin is that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And there was a really interesting stock to flow model that was introduced to crypto from the commodities space from a guy called Plan B. That'll probably be a little bit too technical, but essentially what Bitcoin does is it follows the stock to flow ratio pretty accurately, just in terms of the amount of Bitcoin in existence, the amount that's going to be mined. If we look at every 4 years, Bitcoin gets halved in terms of the mining of it. So every 210,000 blocks or every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoin being created or mined each day halves. So that means that if the buy pressure still remains, then there's going to be less supply, which then drives up prices.
And the safety in this is that it's not a government making the decision about these parameters. This is set in a, you know, something that was launched once and it's not going to change. And it's the complex problems in the blockchain rather than someone agreeing they want to have some inflation in the economy, so they start printing more dollars. This is a set thing that's not going to change by any political means.
Yeah, exactly. So we went from, you know, in gold we trust when currency used to be backed by gold or the gold standard. Now we, you know, traditionally throughout history, we've gone off the gold standard when we needed to increase military spend. So that's why, you know, the gold standard was super important to maintain sort of economic stability. That economic stability has changed over the years to marry up with being taken off the gold standard. But that gold standard basically held that if you went into a bank and you gave your dollar over the counter, you would get, you know, whatever the X amount of gold for that dollar bill or whatever. Once that, now we can get into a, like a history lesson around sort of France, Europe, World War II, and the reason why there was a shortage of gold in Europe, but there was held against, they tried to trade in the US dollars. In 71, Nixon decided to make, you know, the decision to basically just decouple gold completely. But I think we'll probably go down a tangent, not useful for this conversation. So
yeah, I think the interesting thing for me, the sort of takeaway from this is that when Nixon decoupled gold, what it meant is that the US government effectively realized they had the license to print money because it no longer needs to be backed by something. And that's been repeated by a lot of other democratic governments around the world. So we've got this situation today, very topical in COVID, where I think something like 40% of the US dollars that have ever existed have been printed in the last 2 years, or possibly even since last March, March 2020. So that's, it's probably a different conversation where all of that money goes. But one of the reasons why there's less confidence in that money is because if you can keep on printing it, that scarcity value goes away. So coming back to what we're talking about with Bitcoin, what you touched on, Trent, is that there's a set amount that's ever going to be in existence, and that's hard written into the code, and it's very, very difficult to change that because the whole thing's decentralized, so no one party can go and change it. I think this would be a good point to actually talk a little bit about decentralization. Like, what does that mean, and why is that important to this whole like set of economies that we're seeing being built around cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, so decentralization is not just important in the areas of, let's just say, finance, like what Bitcoin has done and was revolutionized that. It basically showed you that you did not need a bank to be able to send money internationally, or it basically brought to the forefront sort of peer-to-peer transacting. And in the absence of or cash, because, you know, there's currently cash worldwide, there's a bit of a war on it. What Bitcoin was able to show and other, you know, following cryptocurrencies was that through decentralization, you do not need permission. Your economic or financial interactions are not governed by a border. Essentially, you're borderless. And there is a certain neutrality to it that you do not have to go through someone. So, for instance, when WikiLeaks got sanctioned or basically put on a sanctions list in 2010, they were no longer able to interact with anyone. From a financial perspective, you know, fortunately, Bitcoin was there to be able to provide that. So under a centralized system, it is very easy for whoever governs that system to say who can play and who can't. In a decentralized system, even though Satoshi Nakamoto in 2010, you know, didn't really want WikiLeaks to get involved with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin was still in its infancy and they didn't want this big spotlight from, you know, the US government and regulators. It was able to provide WikiLeaks the ability to be able to sustain themselves and continue on. And so if we look at the real crux of what decentralization means, there is a central arbiter or a central, you know, authority that tells you what you can and you can't do, and they basically facilitate that. So as with a bank, you know, if we look at how we sort of function at the moment, my girlfriend tried to send me $5,000 for to my company, and her bank basically blocked it because we were, you know, that bank account had been termed or deemed a crypto account, which it was. But if you have a centralized authority like that, then they can tell you what you can or can't do. But with this decentralization, what it does is it basically makes code law. So, you know, where in, you know, we went from being in God we trust, in government we trust, in gold we trust, to in code we trust. So we take out human actors, because if we look at game theory, particularly incentives, people are inherently self-motivated, self-driven to self-preserve. And so if you take out that human element and you embed through code a set of programmable or programmatic laws that governs a system, then there is no favoring, there is no cronyism. It is something that's able just to operate through natural code law.
Yeah, I love the way you've explained that. And I think also, yeah, code doesn't favor party A over party B. There's no cronyism, there's no racism, no classism, none of that. But it also doesn't discriminate against bad actors either. And that's where the likes of Bitcoin have had, you know, it's had some bad press, because I remember several years ago, it was treated as if, well, this is, you know, this is a place where drug deals happen and money laundering happens and all of that kind of stuff.
It was the thing for the Silk Road and these kind of things were going on. Yeah. But I actually, as I heard Trent speaking about it, all I could see is you explained very articulately what value means. And I feel like there's this other exponential component that, as a human, there's this other value that it has, that is, there's no humans fucking with the way that it's going to happen with their own personal interests. And
this is the thing, right? And just on that Silk Road, there's an amazing book, whose name I forget, but it's all about the Silk Road and
The Dread Pirate Roberts.
This book for entrepreneurs, it's amazing because there's so many good entrepreneurial principles in there. I mean, apart from the fact that this was a illegal website, it was, what he put together was pretty incredible. But the other thing, another analogy that I like to use, if you look at decentralization and why it's problematic, is that just because this is the way that it's happened. We've got huge centralization in the tech industry. So you've got these big platforms like Facebook and Twitter, and it's quite worrying that they can cancel whoever they feel like canceling, whether we agree with those policies or not. So I think that's really accelerated this idea that, hang on a second, that kind of centralized power is problematic, because as you said, Trent, humans act in self-interest, and we're starting to see a spotlight on that through the fact that information's so open now that at the highest levels that there's a lot of nefarious activity going on.
Well, I'm a big believer in radical. The word has completely just escaped me. Accountability, radical accountability. I'm a big believer in Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative. If you want something to be, like if you want to do something, then you have to allow that to be a universal rule. And what I find, there tend to be a lot of hypocrites that, you know, will want to do something if I don't want other people to do it. It's like, well, if I want to be able to participate in a completely borderless, permissionless, censorship resistant ecosystem, then criminals should be able to do that, like regardless of what my own personal principles are. And so it is completely open. And so, but you're right, there is a lot of sort of bad press. The media, you know, will put out sensationalist articles, which unfortunately tends to drive public opinion. Now, I'd love to go on a whole different, you know, rant about human beings just being programmable machines that all they do is regurgitate, don't have any original thinking. And
but that's a wonderful rabbit hole that we should save for an episode.
Yeah, that is something I'd love to go on a rant on, because I've got some thoughts around that. But when we look at...
That's a good tie into your war on cash and this, and why it is important that we are able to operate in this accountable world that's held to the same standards on both sides, regardless of personal motive.
Yeah. So the question is around war on cash, or the standards that we operate around?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on it earlier when you said there is this war on cash, but this solution to it, and tying into the esoteric reasons why that kind of exists.
Yeah, why it exists and why we should be paying attention to it.
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of people in the West will know more about their favorite NFL players or their favorite sport player or their team's stats than they do about the policies that govern their everyday life. They know more about what's happening on their favorite show and what's going on with their favorite character than they do about, you know, how the monetary system operates and how they're consistently getting shafted on a day-to-day basis through government taxes, inflation, which is like a hidden tax if you listen to Milton Friedman. But the war on cash is something that's happening right from, you know, under everyone's nose, and it's out in clear and broad daylight. Now, the majority of the money supply is in the form of bank deposits and digital numbers on a screen. One of the last vestiges of traditional peer-to-peer private transacting on value is what we would call cash. So Hollis, you and I can conduct a transaction completely outside the purview of any authority, government, regulator. And that's what peer-to-peer transacting is. But it's actually been openly under attack from global governments that have put it under the guise of removing black or illegal money from the money supply. Now, globally, countries have been implementing these cash bans, limits, removing denominations from the currency supply in a move to go completely digital, which for a billion plus people without access to modern banking and finance has and will continue to be fatal for them. So when Modi in 2016 removed the top two denominations of the Indian currency, the West looked at it and thought, wow, this is amazing. He's so progressive. And it's like, fudge, you just burned a whole underclass of people that operated purely in a, you know, a cash to cash, peer to peer basis. Not to mention all the crap that went down because of that. But globally, as we see, you know, like most government waged wars, people have had their civil liberties and financial freedoms encroached upon. So the war on cash is no different. So having the flexibility and the opportunity to choose your economic expression is, you know, a freedom that is deemed dangerous for some reason, because criminals or terrorists or organizations like WikiLeaks basically wanting to transact that way. And so a big blanket cover is put over everyone. So, you know, from a government's perspective, firstly, it must be suppressed, restricted, replaced and banned, at least these criminal enterprises run rampant in the domain of cash. And so obviously that was a little bit of a philosophical sort of just nugget, but what does this look like? So examples of this war on cash would be the removal of high denomination currencies or notes from the money supply, imposing a cash ban or cash limit for transactions like we've experienced in Australia. Just quickly, we had a bill go through Parliament where they were looking to ban cash transactions over $10,000, which to the everyday layperson would be like, that's fine. I don't spend $10,000 in cash in any one transaction. But if we look at the boiling frog approach that governments typically take, where they bring in something, get it passed through, get it approved, the people go, yeah, that's fine. And then they take it from 10,000 down to 5,000 to 2.5 to 1,000 and then complete ban. So there are a number of reasons why this is happening and why it's going to be detrimental to the everyday, you know, person wanting to live their life. One, there's going to be a tighter surveillance and control on all capital and monies going in and out of your bank accounts. And you'll be taxed accordingly. Like, it's absolutely ridiculous what you guys get taxed in the US there, Hollis. You know, speaking to friends in New York and California, it's ridiculous. They'll also be able to monitor, censor, and shut down dissenters that diverge from the political will of the government. So if you vote for, you know, a potential, you know, party that is deemed dangerous or that the current government doesn't agree with, then your bank can get frozen. So if we look at Citibank freezing accounts for anyone that posted on Facebook that were potentially deemed pro Hong Kong, that had their bank accounts frozen. So if we look at the Chinese social credit scoring system, in terms of if you're going to be a good citizen, you have a certain social credit score. If that drops below a certain amount, then you have to move to a different suburb with other delinquents like yourself. So anyway, if we look at it from a bank perspective, if we look at Europe, they're in already negative interest rates. So the way to escape negative interest rates is to take your money out of the bank. You take and you leave that that system of control. Negative interest rates will basically force depositors to either pay interest or go into the economy and consume and spend. Now, we already are consumption-based population or global population. So there's going to be either downward pressure on savings, which would put upward pressure on spending and debt. But essentially, it's going to put people into more debt because they're not going to want to pay interest to a bank just to hold their money. But anyway, that's get a little bit passionate about that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
I remember in our first conversation, I liked that, but I knew we would have many side conversations on that. But I do think there is a reason why people should know some of the theoretical, ethical, and historical reasons why some of this is actually a shining light towards some solution, towards some possibly not so happy outcomes for humanity. Yes. But to going back, I guess, into our world of DeFi and NFT, if we could open that can of worms in a way that maybe we could explain that to the audience of the amount of people who've asked what this NFT thing means, because I think it ties very much into DeFi. I'm sure Niroj, you can pose the question better, but I think that's
it. It's pretty much what you said. I think anyone who's had any sort of exposure to crypto, and now a bunch of people who haven't, they've seen this NFT thing in the headlines, and that some piece of digital art sold for 69 million, and some NBA clips that you can get everywhere else sold for millions and millions. So it'd be good to I think we'll probably start with DeFi because that leads us directly from the conversation we're just having. So it'd be great if you can explain a little bit about what that actually is, and then from there give us a bit of a view on, you know, what NFTs are and what they mean.
Yeah, so essentially decentralized finance, no central authorities, no intermediaries, non-custodial, basically meaning no one is managing your crypto on your behalf. When we look at reasons why DeFi has really, you know, sort of come to the fore, it's because of these reasons, but it's also because in opposition to the traditional banking system, the next generation millennials, some Gen X, you know, Gen Z, are looking to a more efficient manner of being able to interact. A digital age requires digital assets or digital finance. And that's where decentralized finance really comes into it, because it's borderless, it's global, it's permissionless. You don't need to ask a bank to participate. You don't need to have a house that you need to put up as security or assets to get loans. It's open and accessible to anyone with internet access. In Melbourne, where I live, I can get access to DeFi applications just as easily as someone with internet access in Nigeria or Alaska or Antarctica. So there are basically a broad range of DeFi services and products that you can go to. And the way that we could sort of really look at it is that all became really possible with, you know, smart contracts, which is where Ethereum basically opened up that whole door to where Bitcoin's basically said, this is the internet of money. Ethereum came and said, well, this is the internet of everything else, because you're able to create these smart contracts that basically gave breath to DeFi. And also is what made this whole digital contracts that are enforced by code to facilitate traditional contracts, transactions, and exchanges, and have, you know, through proof of blockchain or, you know, full visibility and transparency to these agreements.
Have you got a good analogy for what a smart contract is? Because I think that that's another one of these terms that's being bandied around, which people don't really fully understand what that means.
Yeah. So essentially, a smart contract is, it's not necessarily smart in itself. It's essentially just adheres to a set of parameters that have been coded into it. But 2017, 2018, you would have seen the ICO boom. And if you sent your money or you contributed to one of those ICOs, then you would have interacted most likely with a smart contract where if it received X amount of Ethereum, it would distribute X amount of whatever the ICO token was. So, users no longer needed to trust any centralized system or Hollis to go, all right, I'm going to send you your tokens. It basically just interacted.
So you don't need someone to sign it and check it and send it on. It's just, if this happens, then that happens. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, a really good analogy I heard on that. And I think with me being a little bit newer to the space, I've probably come across this stuff a lot in the last few months. But a vending machine is the perfect analogy because, it's the kind of like pre-internet version of a smart contract where you perform an action. It checks if you perform the action. Did you put the right, coin in? Did you make a selection or whatever? And then it automatically it gives you a performance based on what that first action was. And I think when I heard that, that really made me understand this is what every smart contract is.
Yes.
Until your ruffles get stuck against the little clip and you're shaking the machine.
And that's when your mechanics fail. And that's, I'm sure in the early days when people were trying to make this work, there was a lot of failed attempts. And then at some point they figured it out, got it right. And that's where the whole Ethereum network came from. That's my guess. I've not looked into it, but it seems pretty robust now. I mean, I know there's issues with Ethereum with gas fees and stuff like that, but the way I think about it is Bitcoin's like the gateway drug to crypto, but Ethereum is the plumbing, it's the infrastructure, at least as things stand today.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think you mentioned before as well, just about NFTs. You know, essentially non-fungible tokens. So fungible means that it can be exchanged or interchanged for another identical item. So for instance, currency is fungible, Bitcoin is fungible. But non-fungible means unique, cannot be replaced, one of a kind, with no tangible form. They essentially live in the digital world. So NFTs can be really anything digital. It could be drawings, paintings, music, movies, be property. Like, you can basically make most things an NFT. So if we look at art, it's valuable because it's one of a kind. Digital files can be copied and duplicated, but that's where, Bitcoin through blockchain basically solves the double spend problem. How can you just replicate the same transaction? So the same thing happens with NFTs through, once again, through code, Coder's Law, that this is a unique identifier and cannot be duplicated. So you can tokenize the art and create a digital certificate of ownership, which can then be traded. And just, I think, as you mentioned, Beeple's, you know, his NFT sold for 69 million. Now, it's very easy for someone to look at that and go, hang on a sec, that's just a dude, like, that has no value. Like, why the F did that sell for 69 million?
Yeah, I can have a picture of the same thing, right? Like, well, I can have a screenshot of the same thing.
A Picasso, you know, how much was the paint that he used? How much was the canvas? And why is that selling for tens of millions? So, like, it's not... what's all relative is what the marketplace is deeming, what is value. And the market will tell you that this is now worth 69 million. It doesn't matter what a critic says. Critics are great at criticizing. But if we really look at it, just the value of it, I believe it was a whole collection of his art over 15 years, which each one of those pieces, you know, was a lot of time, energy, money invested into it. And it's this collection of everything, and basically it just showed the high art world, you know, what's possible. Like, this now, you know, beyond Banksy and street art, it's like, well, this is that next iteration. You know, a digital world once again needs digital assets, and NFTs are essentially those tokens that can be thought of as certificates of ownership of virtual or physical assets. I was
getting close to understand. It was very early in this before it was all over the internet with NFTs and people explaining it. I had a friend whose dad passed away and left him a handful of memorabilia of Babe Ruth, like a ball and a bat and a glove. And he was about to go through the process. And this is one of my most frugal friends from high school, of paying an authenticator like $100 to do this whole process. And then his brother's like, no, we just have to make an NFT for it. And I still don't exactly know what they did or what process you tactically go through if I want to take this and do that. But the fact that these two dudes were able to do it made me realize it's probably not as complicated as it seems. And he was excited about it because now he had a digital value for these assets that he had inherited.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I'm not a collector and by any stretch of the imagination, but I haven't actually really been getting too involved. I'm invested within a project, from a token perspective, that has really sort of just opened my eyes to it. It's a project called Ikomi, where, you know, they got the DC licenses. So I really love Batman. So it's like this augmented reality. And I just put my Batman in my living room with me. And whenever I'm out, I just show friends my Batman. And it's really weird because that's something that I've just never been interested in. But it's bringing like a new wave of people, not just from a collectibles perspective, but from an investment perspective as well, right? Because, I mean, there's a huge craze around NFTs. There's a huge craze around meme coins like Shiba Inus or Shibu Inu or whatever they're called, those Japanese dogs. Like, these meme coins are just absolutely going nuts. NFTs are going nuts. DeFi is going nuts. And so from a real world perspective in terms of interacting with this business, I have collectibles, but from an investment perspective as well, I'm also seeing like my invested funds getting put to work, you know, better than I would ever probably realize within traditional equities, for instance. Not to say that equities are bad, but just personally for my own portfolio, this space is just way more interesting. And it's to things like NFTs. And I'm not invested in meme coins, by the way,
At all. Just before we get into that, I think with NFTs, and this applies to so many elements of blockchain technology, but this is a really good, like, tangible example. The digital art thing, I think that's a starting point, and it's going to be really interesting to see where that goes. And I'm not going to go too far down that because it's a bit more abstract for someone to understand. But a really great example of this, Trent, you must have seen this, and Hollis, you may have, but the Kings of Leon, their last album a few months ago, they released a bunch of NFTs, and they basically, one of the examples in there, they had their top package, and it was once a year you get 4 front row seats to any headline show that they do for the length of time that they're going to be performing as a band. And what NFTs makes really interesting is that if I buy their NFT, and then in 3 years' time, I don't want it. But Kings of Leon have become more popular, and Hollis is a massive Kings of Leon fan, then I can just sell him that NFT, and now he has the right to have those 4 seats. And before, he had the code that could support this kind of provenance of scarcity, and as you said, it's non-fungible, it can't be copied. So that way it's transacted, there's no central authority, there's no nothing. And the really interesting thing is that an artist can get a royalty on that secondary sale in perpetuity as well, so they could get like whatever percentage they want, but at the moment 10% is being said. So number one, for artists, it creates a revenue stream because they could never get secondary ticket sales, all that kind of stuff. But then it also creates this entirely new type of product that was just too awkward and too illiquid to do before. But now we can, and I think we're going to see so much stuff like that when people's imagination takes off.
Oh, this is awesome. I end up Googling that immediately because I have paid a lot of money for Kings of Leon shows, and they generated $2 million in the launch of that. And a band who probably made most of their money from touring and that, and now they have this money into the future. And
yeah, it's really cool because the music has been, the value in the music's been cannibalized, and that may change in the future. But if Kings of Leon become more popular, then the value of my NFT goes up, and if they become less popular, it goes down. But the fact that I can even trade an asset like that, that's just it just could not have been done before. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I mean, they're just really interesting, future applications. You could, in terms of movies, instead of being backed by, producers or whoever funds movies, you could basically just sell off different scenes and just, create an NFT wrapper. And basically when the film's released, all revenues go to, the NFT holders. You can create like some really amazing ones. There's actually, I don't think that's coming out yet, so I won't be able to talk on that, but there's some really cool stuff happening right now. And I think that the future is basically the rails are all being built now. So when we look at like open marketplaces like OpenSea and Rarible, which basically gives anyone the opportunity to create their own NFT. And so for curated art communities or curated collectible communities, they may look at that and be like, that's not curated because anyone can do it and there's just a whole lot of crap out there. But what that's essentially doing is we're basically really stretching innovation right now to what's possible and creating those rails for future innovation. And so I think, with the application of NFTs in the future, there is so much already being explored now. It's even hard to imagine what's possible in the future.
Yeah, I think when a lot of this stuff collides, and this is a conversation of a different day, but when we see the collision of blockchain and metaverse and digital worlds and the tradability of assets in there, so when all of those things happen, over the next 5 to 15 years, it's just going to create a whole new bunch of business models because we're going to be able to do things that we just could never do before. Now, without wanting to get too abstract on that stuff, I'm pretty keen to get into some of the questions because there's some just really interesting stuff in there. Before we do that, I mean, what's your view in terms of, you know, do you see family offices and institutions continuing to hold this interest in Bitcoin and crypto going into next year and a year after and so on?
Yeah, so speaking from personal experience, the answer is yes. Also from market insights. And by personal experience, I mean my company, ZeroCap. Our whole customer segment are family offices, high net worth institutions. Smart investors or smart money needs to stay ahead of the investment curve. Right now, there's a huge paradigm shift within the investment space. What we are, particularly with our customers, is in a re-education of the patriarchs and matriarchs, or the first, second generations, you know, within family offices, which typically tend to be in that baby boomer generation. We noticed a lot of them come in after March last year during the credit crunch because they wanted a hedge against inflation. And basically, you know, a government orgy of stimulus where it's been, and basically we've spent the last year and a half getting educated. That's not to say all family offices or institutions are getting involved, but, you know, from our end, we're definitely seeing these families looking towards the future. How do they get their children engaged, the millennials, the Gen Zs? I was in a lunch yesterday with some family offices that their children were just not rocking up to the meetings, basically the investment meetings, because it, and from my take on it, was they're not interested in property, bonds, equities. But what these families did say, or the principals did say, was that these their children are nonstop talking to them about crypto. So it's almost like some have looked at it because as a hedge against inflation, some, based on those conversations yesterday, are looking at it as a way for to drive future engagement with their kids. So their kids can be a part of the family investment vehicle. So I think a lot of the smart investors understand diversification, particularly within portfolios. You know, one of the main reasons that you have equity and bonds allocation split is the need to hedge. You know, when one goes up, the other goes down, et cetera. If we look at institutions, actually just coming back to those family offices. So the reason why I see it going and progressing 2022 to 2023 is that these aren't just meme coins that the kids are talking about. This is actually a whole gamut of decentralized finance applications that are basically the building blocks for the future of finance. And so that's where a lot of our education goes into with these families. When they talk to us about risk, this, you know, we hear it's a scam. Then we basically put into the broader context the macroeconomic conditions affecting the world at the moment and how Bitcoin, crypto, DeFi fits into that. They don't need to be invested in meme coins or NFTs because they're more about generational preservation rather than, you know, the volatility. Now, that so, but if we look at the institutions, then we really got to look at MicroStrategy, which really just came out the gates, you know, late last year. And basically reimagined cash treasury by taking, you know, a good portion, if not most of it, if not all of it, and put it into Bitcoin because Bitcoin was a better store of value than cash. And Michael Saylor, the CEO, just basically called holding cash is like holding a mounting ice cube. And so we saw Tesla put $1.5 billion in, I think, which represented like 8% of their cash reserves. Square put in 1%. There are rumors that Zuckerberg has basically been accumulating a huge position within Bitcoin and is going to be, you know, one of the biggest institutional whales out there. So to answer that question, there's strong interest. It will continue. There will be probably some corrections. It's a pretty frothy market at the moment. But if you look at the correction 2 weeks ago, it wasn't even much of a correction. It was like a 15% drop that immediately got bought back up. So Bitcoin drops. If we look at And the great thing about blockchain is we can track all the wallets. We can see what wallets are selling, which wallets are holding. Most of the wallets that were selling during that period 2.5 weeks ago were ones that had only held Bitcoin for a few days. But if we look at the long-term whale holders, they were accumulating, they were buying up those Bitcoin the whole time. Now, if we look at institutions, whales, high net worths, they're buying, they're not selling during these little 15% drops. So yes, the answer is a big resounding yes.
Cool. So related to that, is it too late to get in if somebody started from scratch today? Like, is this the wrong time in a market to try and start taking a position?
Yeah, it's too late. It's always going to be too late if you really look at it. It was too late for people, like if someone got in 2017, in 2017 you thought you were too late because someone got in at 2015. It's always the grass is greener, right? Now, even if someone did get in, like back in 2012 when it was cents or whatever, the chances of them holding would have been zero. So you always get these people that look back and they're like, oh, is it too late? And if only I'd got in then, I'd be a billionaire right now. And the truth is that they wouldn't have had the conviction to have actually held onto Bitcoin, because Bitcoin basically dropped 90% at least five times, you know, leading up to the last bull run. So who the F would keep an asset with that type of volatility? But the ones that did, they had conviction, right? So the past, it's a no if you're looking towards the future, because really we're not even at mass adoption yet. We're still in that early adopter, early majority phase. And it all comes down to what your strategy is, right? If you're looking to get rich quick, then there are huge opportunities right now that you can, you know, gamble on, you can educate yourself on. It's a double-edged sword. You either get rich or you get broke. Like, if you want to get rich quick, then you want volatility because you want, you know, those 10Xs, but you also should be prepared for those, you know, going to zeros. If you're wanting to build generational wealth, then now is the right time, because if we look at, for instance, let's just use Bitcoin as an asset. Bitcoin's at $1 trillion market cap. Right now, every market money manager on the planet is looking at it now, seriously. Like before, you know, when it was 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, they weren't necessarily looking as much. Wealth advisors weren't able to recommend it. But now every one of their customers is asking them, how do I get involved in this? So it's actually a fiduciary responsibility for them to actually get to understand the space. So it is not too late to get in right now, but it all comes down to, once again, what your strategy is. I'm a big fan of radical accountability. So, you know, learn, educate yourself, understand what you're investing in. Understand that if you invest in something, there is a chance that it will go to zero. So if you're looking for that get rich, I just want to do nothing and put money in and hope I become a millionaire like the lotto, then you may hit it, you may not. Like, you could be one of those really fortunate investors. But I think what I'd like to probably just communicate to the community here is that I definitely recommend going in with a strategy. It's not too late. If we look at banking and finance right now, then, you know, there are billions of people that are unbanked, but the whole world has internet. So if we look at the future of finance, we're dealing right now, we're invested in these projects right now. These tokens are trading right now. There's a good chance that in the next few months that there's going to be a big pullback because of just the frothiness right now. Is that a bad thing? I don't think so. I think market corrections are great.
I can't wait. I'm waiting for it. So, you know, sort of being relatively new to crypto, but being pretty experienced as an investor, it's the best time, because that's when you pick things up for cheap, but then you have to go against every instinct of what everybody else is doing.
Yes. And, you know, with crypto, it's like, so for Bitcoin, right? If we look at, we spoke about the supply schedule before, it's halving every 4 years. The amount in supply is getting reduced, the scarcity. It's not too late to get involved in that. If you're looking at DeFi projects that have just had a huge run-up, is it too late? It's unsure. If you're wanting to trade, it's not too late. If you're wanting to hold for the long term, then there is going to be a significant more amount of risk. And so really, once again, just coming back to that strategy, I really urge education and understanding, knowing what you're getting invested in, and putting aside the right amount of capital for you that you're willing to lose. And if you want, you know, for millennials that have been priced out of the property market, they want volatility because they need that volatility to be able to catch up to, you know, the Gen X's or the baby boomers. And so they're diving deep into this space. But once again, if you're just hoping, like putting money into a project, hoping, and because you watched some YouTube clip that it's going to go up, chances are if that YouTuber has a lot of followers, then it will go up, but just be prepared for the dump and just be really on top of your investments.
Cool. Thanks for that. I think of those smaller coins, which are, you know, sort of earlier in their journey and in their projects, that to me, they're lottery tickets. It's you know, that mentality helps me understand how to think about it so that, yeah, it could 10x, it could go to zero. And I think it's actually useful to kind of always remember that on pretty much everything that isn't, in my personal opinion, everything that isn't Bitcoin or ETH at this stage. And then in between, you've got a bunch of things that are somewhat developed, but it's interesting.
Yeah. We've eaten up close to the time I know you have allotted to be with us here today. So I'd love to maybe we throw like one more question out, and then if you're cool with it, we have a follow-up to get into, I think, the sexy meat of this now that we've laid down the bones, which is all the things outside of the financial institutions and stuff that this can be applied to, which I'm looking at the questions. There's a lot that apply to things outside of this.
I think if we're going to do that, because I agree that this is a really good sort of foundational conversation, and we've thrown a lot of stuff out there, and if we did get together again, then we could dig deeper in some of this other stuff. But so a couple of questions that I think are really interesting to wrap this one up is, Trent, two things. One, is there a fundamental misconception about Bitcoin or crypto or blockchain that you just wish more and people understood that we haven't talked about already? So we'll go with that. And if we've got time, there's one more, but if not, then we can cut it.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that that Bitcoin has no value. That would probably be a misconception about it, because it's almost like value needs to be applied by some sort of centralized institution. But once again, coming back to marketplaces, the market has driven the value, and the last 12 years of Bitcoin being in existence has basically been punching us in the face with value. Institutional investors are validating that value. So I'd say the biggest misconception about Bitcoin is the whole value piece. And then, you know, as well as the criminal piece, like criminals use it, money launderers use it. They also use the US dollars. Like, I mean, it's sort of a redundant argument. So.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Nurse.
No, I was going to say, then I guess maybe the one to end on is there something that you can see in this world that you can see brewing that everyone's going to take for granted 5 years from now?
I would say, having a DeFi hedge fund run by school kids with 70, 80 or 90 million in total value locked in it, like, investors, and this is an actual project, Rary Capital. It's a bunch of teenagers, smart teenagers. But I think that's just something people right now is just like, why would you have 90 million trusted to these kids? And it's, well, they're not entrusted to the kids, they're trusted to the code, which can be audited, can be validated by anyone out there. But they're basically building these applications. And so I think that's just going to be commonplace. It doesn't matter about who developed it, who coded it. It can be audited, it can be tested, certified, whatever. I think that's going to be pretty commonplace. I think that there will also be more commonplace is probably community coins, you know, baby bathwater, where as opposed to interacting in US dollars or any currencies, I'm not exactly, you know, sure about the actual flow of funds within the baby bathwater community, but there might be tokens, and that just might be really commonplace. In 5 years, you go to a baby bathwater event and you have, you know, you have to contribute a certain amount of tokens, or, and for people that are promoting or for people that are contributing content or whatever to it, they get allocated from the treasury certain amounts of community tokens. So I think that that's probably something as well. I think definitely like through the NFTs, you know, fractionalizing real estate, fractionalization of the Mona Lisa. So all of a sudden, instead of one owner, you know, holding the Mona Lisa in their own private art gallery, it is 1 million owners of the Mona Lisa that all own a fraction of it. And that has been turned into an NFT that they can, you know, go into their own virtual art gallery that all those million people share together. I mean, I'm just spitballing at the moment, but yeah, that's what I would think.
I think that was a pretty good spitball of things that become commonplace that would freak you out at the moment. You know,
that last analogy, because you have a million owners and every year you could have a vote of where we're going to hang it this year. It goes to this gallery, that gallery, whatever, you know, that's pretty cool, because to get a vote, you buy a share.
Right. And then someone buys the majority of shares because they really want to ensure that it happens that you're there, whatever, and you have those things. Well, Trent, I want to respect your time, and I hope that we get to spend some more together. I really appreciate you taking the time, and Raj taking the time to be on your Helpless Guide through this. As soon as those borders open up, we'll get into real life and have a good time and get you into our world. And I hope people can check out Zero Cap, and we can have a follow-up here to continue this conversation. I think this group and what you're doing are very aligned in many things, and you're clearly educated and down the rabbit hole and also doing it for the right reasons, which I think is the reason it's the first time we've done an interview like this. It's been hard to find people who are involved in this space, like we kind of talked about before the call, but for the right reasons.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for having me, guys. Great conversation. Always happy to jump into other ones in the future if you guys like.
Awesome.
Thanks, Trent.
Tally ho.
Sweet.